Track 4.
The woman fluffed out her grubby petticoats and dropped onto the bench opposite Hal. "You're a real prince, you are," she peered into his face. "And the handsomest the devil, too." "What is your name, my beauty?" Hal asked. "Mifrau Markenbach," she answered. "But you may call me Hannah." Daniel returned with a square bottle of gin and a tumbler. He poured it to the brim. Hannah lifted it with her little finger raised and took a ladylike sip. She did not wince at the ferocity of the pale spirit. "So, Hannah," Hal smiled at her, and she wriggled like a puppy under his gaze. "There's nothing that goes on here at Good Hope that you don't know about, is there now?" "That's God's own truth, if I say it myself." She showed the gaps in her teeth again. "Anything you want to know, sir, you ask old Hannah." She was as good as her word. For the next hour, Hal sat opposite her and listened to what she had to tell him. He found that behind the raddled face and blurry, gin-sodden eyes lurked the remnants of a once bright intelligence. It seemed that she knew the sexual mores and leanings of every male and female in the settlement, from Governor Van der Stel to the dock workers and transport drivers. She could tell them the price of all the produce in the market, from potatoes to mampur, the fiery peach brandy made by the burghers. She knew which slaves were for sale, the prices their owners were asking, and what they would accept. She knew the sailing dates of every ship in the bay, her captain's name, her cargo, and every port of call on her route. She could give them an account of each ship's latest voyage, the hazards and hardships she had encountered. "Tell me, Hannah, why are there so many VOC ships lying in the bay?" He was referring to the Vereenigde Oost-Indische Compagnie, the Dutch East India Company.
"Those are all outward bound for Batavia. Governor van der Stel has ordered that all ships sailing eastward must sail in convoy under the protection of warships."
"Why, Hannah, would he want to do that, do you think?"
"Because of Djangiri. You have heard of Djangiri, have you not?"
Hal shook his head. "No. Who is he? Or it?"
"The Sword of the Prophet. That's what he calls himself. But he's nothing more than a bloody pirate. Worse than Frankie Courtney himself. That's what he is."
Hal exchanged a glance with Abele. Both men were taken aback to have his father's name thrown at them so carelessly, and to know that Sir Francis and his exploits were still so well remembered hereabouts. Hannah had not noticed their reaction. She took a gulp of her gin and laughed raucously.
"In the last 6 months, 3 VOC ships have disappeared from the ocean of the Indies. Everybody knows it's Djangiri's doing. They do say he's cost the company 1 million guilders already."
Her eyes lit up with wonder.
"Ah, 1 million guilders. I did not know there was that much money in the world."
She leaned across the table to stare into Hal's face. Her breath smelt like a dung heap, but Hal did not recoil. He did not want to risk giving her offence.
"You looked like somebody I know." She puzzled over it for a moment. "Were you ever here at the Good Hope before? I never forget a face."
Hal shook his head, and Big Daniel chuckled.
"Hey, perhaps, missus, if he showed you his pink end, you would recognize it for certain. Better than his face, that is."
Hal frowned at him, but by this time the gin bottle was half empty, and Hannah cackled.
"I'd paid 1 million guilders for a side of that."
She leered at Hal. "Do you want to come back in the back with Hannah? There'll be no charge for it, such a lovely man you are." "Next time," Hal promised her.
"I do know you," she insisted. "When you smile like that, I know you. It will come back to me. And never forget a face."
"Tell me more about Djangiri," he suggested to divert her. But she was losing her wits now. She refilled her tumbler and held up the empty bottle.
"Everyone I love goes off and leaves me," she said, tears flooding her eyes. "Even the bottle don't stay with me long."
"Djangiri," Hal insisted. "Tell me about Djangiri."
"He's a bloody Muslim pirate. He burns Christian sailors just to hear them scream."
"Where does he come from? How many ships does he command? What strength are they?"
"One of my friends was on the ship that Djangiri chased but didn't catch," she slurred. "Oh, he's a lovely boy. He wants to marry me and take me home to Amsterdam."
"Djangiri?" Big Daniel asked. "Now, you stupid clod of earth," Hannah bristled. "My boyfriend. I forget his name, but he wants to marry me. He saw Jangiri. He was lucky to escape the bloodthirsty heathen."
"Where did this happen, Hannah? When did your friend run across Jangiri?"
"Not 2 months passed. Off the Fever Coast it was, near the Isle of Madagascar."
"What force did Jangiri have?" Hal pressed.
"Oh, many great ships," Hannah said uncertainly. "A fleet of warships. My friend's ship fled."
Hal realized that she was floundering. There was little more she could tell him of importance, but he asked a last question. "Do you know which route the VOC convoy takes on its way to Batavia?"
"South," she said. "They say far south. I have heard that they keep well clear of Madagascar and the islands, for that's where Jangiri skulks, the filthy heathen."
"When will the convoy in the bay sail?" Hal asked. But she was gone into the fogs of alcohol.
"Jangiri is the devil," she whispered. "He is the Antichrist. All true Christians should dread him."
Slowly her head zagged forward, then flopped face down into the puddle of gin on the tabletop. Daniel took a hank of her greasy grey hair and lifted her head to look into her eyes.
"The lady has left us," he said, and let it drop again to hit the wood with a crack.
She rolled off the bench and lay on the floor, snoring loudly. Hal took a silver 10-guilder coin from the purse on his sword belt and pushed it down Hannah's bodice.
"There is more than she'll earn there on her back in a month of Sundays," Big Daniel grunted. "But well worth it," Hal stood up. "That's better intelligence than we could get from Admiral von Reuters himself."
On the beach, Alf Wilson was waiting for them with the longboat. As they rowed back across the bay to the Seraph, Hal sat quietly, digesting all the news Hannah had given him, and weaving it into his plans. By the time he had climbed the rope ladder to the main deck, he knew what he had to do. "Something seemed clear from what Daniel's lady friend told us last night." Hal looked around at the intent faces of his officers, who were crowded into the stern cabin. "The first is that Jangiri has his nest somewhere along here." Hal leaned over the chart spread on his desk and placed his finger on the outline of Madagascar. "From here he can harry the trade routes to the south and east with the greatest ease." Arboli grunted.
"Finding his sally port will be the trick. He does not have to use one of the big islands as his base. There are hundreds of other smaller ones scattered over 2,000 leagues from the Oman coast in the Arabian Sea to the Mascarene Islands in the south."
"You are right," Hal nodded. "Added to those, there are almost certainly dozens of other islands we do not know, that are neither named nor shown on any chart. We might sail 100 years and not discover or explore them all." He looked around their faces.
"If we cannot go to him, then what should we do?"
"Bring him to us," said Ned Tyler.
Again Hal nodded. "Bring him out of his lair. Give him a bait to tease him. The place to do that is off the Fever Coast. We'll have to cruise off the islands of Madagascar and Zanzibar, trail our cloak along the African shore." They muttered in agreement.
"You can be certain he has agents in every port in the Indian Ocean. They send him word of every prize that calls," Daniel told them. "At least that's what I would do, if I were a heathen pirate."
"Yes," Hal turned to him. "We'll call in at every port. Let them know how rich we are, and how poorly armed."
2 fighting ships of 36 guns apiece," Ned Tyler chuckled. "That's enough force to daunt any pirate."
"One ship," Hal said, and smiled when they looked askance.
"I will send the yeoman on alone to Bombay as soon as she arrives here. She can carry our passengers and all the urgent cargo of which we can rid ourselves and cram into her hold. We will sail the Fever Coast on our own."
"The Seraph is still a ship of force," Alf Wilson pointed out. "Enough to frighten off most pirates."
"She will not look like one by the time we are ready to sail."
Hal unrolled the drawings of the ship's hull, on which he had been working since they had crossed the equator.
"A Trojan horse, gentlemen. That is what we shall prepare for Mr. Jangiri." They crowded round the desk, voicing approval, making eager comment and suggestion as they began to see what Hal had in mind.
"What we want to make her into is a rich, fat, unarmed trader. The gunports first."
The next morning, Hal had himself rowed around the ship as she lay at anchor. Ned Tyler and the two ship's carpenters were with him, and he pointed out to them the changes he wanted to make to the Seraph's appearance.
"We can leave all the carving and goldwork as they are," he pointed to the beautiful decorative features on the stern and bows. "They give her a nice decadent air, like the Lord Mayor's barge."
"More like a French whorehouse," Big Daniel sniffed.
"Besides which, Lord Childs will be greatly put out if we damage his little masterpiece." He pointed to the Seraph's sides.
"It's the gunports that must be our prime concern."
The sills of the gunports were picked out in gold leaf, which gave a pleasing checkered effect to the Howl, but emphasized the Seraph's warlike capability.
"You will begin work on them first," Howl ordered the carpenters. "I want the joints of the lids to the gunports concealed. Cork them with tar and repaint them so they blend into the timberwork of the Howl."
For an hour longer they studied the ship from the longboat and decided on other small touches to the Seraph's outline that would make her appear more innocuous. As they rowed back to the ship, Hal remarked to Big Daniel,
"One of the reasons I anchored so far offshore, apart from outranging the guns on the fort, was to keep out of sight of prying eyes on the beach."
He nodded at the bumboats and other small craft still clustered around the ship.
"As soon as the work begins, I want you to warn off those boats.
We must believe that Jangiri has agents in the settlement, and act on that belief. I don't want beady eyes watching everything we do, and busy tongues passing on the news."
Once back in his cabin, Hal penned a letter to Mr. Beatty, addressed to his lodgings in the town, explaining that he and his family would complete the voyage to Bombay in the Yeoman of York when she arrived, and that Guy would accompany him. Hal was glad to arrange this by note, rather than having to persuade Mr. Beatty to make the change by discussion and argument.
"Well now," he said aloud, as he sanded the ink on the paper, "that arrangement will also take care of Master Tom's pugilistic and amorous proclivities."
Once he had placed his wax seal on it, he sent for Big Daniel to carry the letter ashore.
"No sign of the yeoman yet?"
he demanded, as soon as Big Daniel stuck his head in at the door.
"Nothing yet, Captain.
Tell the officer of the watch to call me the minute she puts her topmasts above the horizon."
He had given the same order more than once before, and Big Daniel rolled his eyes and sucked his gums to illustrate his forbearance. Hal concealed a smile. Big Daniel was allowed such familiarity. He stood on the scaffold in the bright morning sunlight. He was still only a lad, perhaps 18 years of age, certainly no older. He was very good-looking. Hannah Markenberg loved it when they were. He was tall and straight-limbed, with long waving hair, raven's wing black, falling to his shoulder. He was terrified, which excited her, as it excited the large crowd around her. Every man, woman, and child in the settlement was there, every burgher and housewife, slave and Hottentot. They were in high spirits, boisterous and playful. Even the very young children were among them, infected by the spontaneous gaiety of the occasion. They chased each other, squealing, between the legs of the adults. Beside Hannah stood one of the Freeburger's wives, a plump, kindly-looking woman in an apron dusted with flour. She'd obviously come directly from baking bread in her kitchen. Her tiny daughter clutched at her apron. She was an angelic child, who sucked her thumb and stared solemnly at the man on the scaffold with huge blue eyes.
"It's her first execution," the mother explained to Hannah. "She feels a little strange and afraid of all the people."
The prisoner's hands were manacled behind his back. He wore ragged seaman's petticoats, and his feet were bare. The magistrate stepped to the front of the scaffold to read the charge and the sentence, and the crowd swayed and jostled with anticipation.
"Now hear the verdict of the court of the Colony of Good Hope. By the grace of God and the power vested in me by charter of the States General of the Republic of Holland."
"Get on with it," howled one of the burghers at the back of the crowd. "Let's see him do his little dance for us."
"It is hereby decreed that Hendrik Martinus Ockers, having been found guilty of the crime of murder..."
"I was there," Hannah told the housewife beside her proudly. "I saw it all.
I even gave evidence at the court. Yes, I did. The woman looked suitably impressed.
Why did he do it? She asked.
Why do any of them do it? Hannah shrugged.
They was both pissing, puking drunk.
She remembered the two figures circling each other, with the long knives gleaming in the eerie lantern light, throwing distorted shadows on the tavern walls, and the shouts and the stamping of the watchers.
How did he do it?
A knife, dearie. He was quick, for all the liquor in his belly. Like a panther he was.
She made a slashing gesture.
Like that, right across his belly. Opened him like a fish on the block. His guts fell clean out of him, tangled at his feet, so he tripped and fell on the face.
Oh!
The housewife shuddered with horrified fascination.
Like animals, these sailors.
All of them, dearie, not just the sailors.
Hannah nodded primly.
All men are the same.
And that's God's truth,
the woman agreed, picked up the child and placed her on her shoulder.
There you are, Leveling. You will get a better view from up there, she told her.
The magistrate reached the end of the proclamation of sentence. The aforesaid Hendrik Martinus Ockers is hereby condemned to death by hanging. Sentenced to be carried out in public on the parade ground of the castle on the morning of the 3rd day of September at 10 o'clock in the forenoon. He moved heavily down the ladder from the scaffold, and one of the guards helped him down the last few steps. The executioner, who had been standing behind the condemned man, stepped forward and placed a black cotton bag over his head.
I hate it when they do that, Hannah grumbled. I like to see his face when he's on the end of the rope, all purple and screwed up.
Slow John never covered their faces, the woman beside her agreed.
Ah, ha, ha! Do you remember Slow John? He was an artist. I'll never forget when he executed Sir Frankie, the English pirate. That was a show.
Remember it like yesterday, Hannah agreed. Worked on him for nearly half an hour before he chopped him. She broke off, as something else nudged her memory. Something to do with the pirates and the pretty lad on the scaffold. She shook her head with irritation. The gin had fuddled her mind. The executioner placed the noose over the prisoner's head and pulled it snug under his left ear. The lad was trembling now. Hannah wished again that she could see his face. The whole scene reminded her of someone. The executioner stood back and picked up his heavy wooden mallet. He took a full swing at the wedge that held the trapdoor. The condemned man gave a pitiful cry.
In God's name, have mercy!
The watchers hooted with laughter. The executioner swung the mallet again and the wedge was knocked out. With a crash, the trap flew open and the man dropped through. He came up short on the rope's end, his neck stretched and his head jerked to the side. Hannah heard the vertebrae snap like a dry twig and was disappointed again. Slow John would have judged it better and had him kicking and jerking at the rope's end for many tantalizing minutes with his life being slowly choked out of him. This executioner was ham-fisted, lacking subtlety. For Hannah, it was all over too swiftly. A few shuddering tremors ran through the condemned man's body, and then he hung quietly, revolving slowly on the noose, his neck twisted at an impossible angle. Hannah turned away, disgruntled. Then she stopped. The memory that had eluded her so long came back with a rush.
"The pirate's boy," she said. "Sir Frankie, the pirate's boy. I never forget a face. I said I knew him."
"Oh, who are you talking about?"
the woman with the child on her shoulder asked.
"Frankie's boy? Who is Frankie's boy?"
Hannah did not bother to reply, but she hurried away, hugging her secret to herself, trembling with excitement. The memory of the events of 20 years ago crowded back. The trial of the English pirates. Hannah had been young and pretty in those days, and she had given one of the guards a little something for free to let her into the courtroom. She had followed the entire trial from her seat in the back row. It had been better entertainment than any play or fair. She saw again the lad, Frankie's son, chained to the pirate, standing side by side with him as old Governor van der Velder sentenced the one to death and the other to a life sentence at hard labour on the castle walls. What was the lad's name? When she closed her eyes, she could see his face so clearly in her mind's eye.
"Henry!" she exclaimed. Henry Courtney. Then 3 years later, the pirates, led by this same Henry Courtney, had broken out of their dungeon in the castle. Hannah would never forget the sounds of shouting and fighting and of musket fire, then the earth-shaking explosion and the vast towering cloud of smoke and dust that rose high in the air as the English ruffians blew up the powder magazine in the castle. With her own eyes, she had watched them gallop out of the castle gates in the carriage they had stolen and take the road that led out into the wilderness. Although the troops from the garrison had pursued them as far as the savage mountains to the north, they had got clean away. After that she remembered seeing the reward posters in the market and in every tavern along the waterfront.
10,000 guilders, she whispered to herself. It was 10,000 guilders.
She tried to imagine such a vast sum of money. With that money I could go back to Amsterdam. I could live like a grand lady for the rest of my life. Then her spirits plunged. Will they still pay the reward after all these years? Her whole body sagged with despair as the great fortune receded from her grasp. I will send Anarchy to find out from her sport at the castle. Anarchy was one of the younger, prettier whores who worked the taverns along the waterfront. Among her regular clients was the governor's clerk, her steamer, in the vernacular of the trade. Hannah lifted her skirts and set off at a run for the waterfront. She knew that Anarchy had a room in De Malmok, one of the most popular of the sailors' taverns, named after the wandering albatross. She was in luck. Anarchy was still stretched out on her stained mattress in the tiny room beneath the eaves. The room stank of men's sweat and lust. Anarchy sat up with her dense black curls in a tangle and her eyes dulled with sleep. "What are you waking me for at this hour? Are you mad?" she whined angrily. Hannah flopped down beside her and blurted out her story. The girl sat up and wiped the cheesy granules of sleep from the inner corners of her eyes. Her expression changed as she listened. "How much?" she asked in disbelief, and crawled off the mattress to gather up her clothing, which was scattered across the floor. "That ship is the Skerolon," she demanded, as she pulled her shift over her head and down over her wobbling white bosom. Hannah balked at the question. There were over 20 ships in the bay, and she had no idea which one her prey was on. Then her expression cleared. Henry Courtney was an English pirate, and there were only 2 English ships in the flotilla, lying out there at anchor. He must be on one of them. "You let me worry about that, Liebling," she told the girl. "All you have to do is find out if there is still a reward, and how we can collect it." The Seraph had been lying at anchor for 15 days before the Yeoman of York finally beat into Table Bay against the southeaster and dropped anchor a cable's length astern of her. Edward Anderson had himself rowed across directly, and as he came up the ladder to the Seraph's deck, he greeted Hal. "I hardly recognised you, Sir Henry. The Seraph looks like a different ship." "Then I have succeeded in my purpose." Hal took him by the arm and led him to the companionway. "What kept you so long?" "Foul winds ever since we parted company. I was carried down within sight of the coast of Brazil," Anderson grumbled. "But I am pleased we are together again." "Not for long," Hal assured him, as he waved him to a chair and poured a glass of Canary wine for him. "As soon as you have revictualled and refurbished the Yeoman, I am sending you on to Bombay alone, while I am going up the coast to seek out this Musselman rover." "That was not what I expected," Anderson spluttered into his wine, as he saw the chance of prize money snatched from him. "I have a good fighting ship and a crew." "Yes, perhaps too good," Hal stopped him. "From news that I have had since arriving here, it seems that our best chance of coming at Jangiri is to offer him a bait. 2 fighting ships are likely to drive him off rather than suck him in." "Ah, so that's why you've changed your appearance," Anderson asked. Hal nodded and went on. "Besides which, there are passengers, urgent mail and cargo for Bombay. Mr. Beatty is in lodgings in the town, waiting for you to convey him and his family to Bombay. The trade winds will not stand fair much longer before the season changes, and the winds turn foul for a crossing of the Ocean of the Indies." Anderson sighed. "And I understand your reasoning, sir, though it is of scant comfort. I am loath indeed to part company with you again. By the time you reach Bombay, the monsoon wind will have changed. You will be able to discharge your cargo and catch that wind to hasten your passage back across the ocean of the Indies to the Fever Coast, where I will be waiting to rendezvous with you.
Oh, that'll take several months, the round trip, Anderson pointed out gloomily.
Hal was pleased that he showed this eager spirit. Other company captains would have been delighted to avoid danger and were well content with the peaceable life of a trader. He tried to mollify him. By the time we meet up again, I will have much better intelligence of Jangiri. By then I may have smelt out his lair. You can be certain that it will need both our forces to smoke him out, and that I will not attempt such an enterprise without the assistance of you and your crew, sir.
Anderson brightened a little. Then I must make all haste to prepare myself for the next leg of the voyage to Bombay. He drained his glass and stood up. I shall go ashore immediately to speak to Mr. Beatty and have him prepare himself and his family to continue the voyage.
I shall send Daniel Fisher, my officer, ashore with you to guide you to Mr. Beatty's lodgings. I would go with you myself, but for various reasons that is not prudent.
He escorted Anderson up the companionway to the deck, and at the rail he told him, I shall have all the cargo and mail for Governor Ungier loaded into my pinnaces and sent across to you tomorrow. I intend to hoist anchor 3 days from now and set out to begin the hunt for Jangiri. My men will be standing by to receive your cargo. By the grace of God, I should be ready to sail myself within 10 days or less.
If you would give me the pleasure of being my guest at dinner tomorrow, we can use the opportunity to agree the details of our future plans.
They shook hands, and Anderson seemed a great deal happier as he went down into the longboat, Big Daniel following him.
Hannah sat on the top of one of the tall sand dunes above the beach, from where she could look out to the flotilla anchored in the bay. Two others were with her, Anarchy and Jan Ulifant. Jan Ulifant was Hannah's bastard son. His father was Kia Ngaka, a powerful Hottentot chief. 30 years previously, while she still had her looks and golden hair, Hannah had accepted from him the gift of a beautiful kaross made from the pelts of the red jackal, in exchange for a knight of her favours. Liaisons between white women and coloured men were strictly forbidden by the VOC, but Hannah had never paid heed to the silly laws made by 17 old men in Amsterdam. Although Jan Ulifant favoured his father in looks and skin colour, he was proud of his European ancestry. He spoke Dutch fluently, carried a sword and musket, and dressed like a burgher. He had earned the name Ulifant from his vocation. He was a famous elephant hunter and a hard, dangerous man. By decree of the VOC, none of the Dutch burghers was allowed to venture beyond the boundaries of the colony. By virtue of his Hottentot lineage, Jan Ulifant was not subject to these restrictions. He could come and go at will, free to range out into the trackless wilderness beyond the mountains and return to sell the precious ivory tusks in the markets of the settlement. His swarthy visage was horrifically mutilated, his nose twisted and his mouth riven through by the shining white scars that started in the thick woolly mat of his hair and ran down to his chin. His shattered jawbone had set askew, giving him a perpetual gaping grin. On one of his first ventures into the interior, while lying by his campfire, a hyena had crept up on his sleeping form and seized a mouthful of his face in its massively powerful jaws. Only a man of Jan Ulifant's formidable physique and strength could have survived such an attack. The beast had dragged him away into the darkness, dangling him beneath its chest like a cat with a mouse. It had ignored the shouts and stones hurled by Jan's companions. Its long yellow fangs were sunk so deeply into his face that the bone of his jaw was crushed, and his mouth and nose were tightly sealed so that he was unable to draw breath. Jan had reached for the knife on his belt, and with the other hand groped under the beast's chest until he found the gap in its ribs through which he could feel the beating of its heart. He had placed the point of the knife carefully, and then made a single powerful upward stroke to kill the brute. He crouched now on the dune between the two women, and his voice was distorted by the damaged nostrils and twisted jawbone.
Mother, are you certain this is the same man?
My son, I never forget a face, Hannah told him doggedly.
10,000 guilders, Jan Ulifant snorted with laughter. No man, living or dead, is worth that much.
It is true, Anarchy cut in vehemently. The reward still stands.
I have spoken to my sport at the castle. He says that the VOC will still pay the full amount.
She grinned avariciously. They will pay dead or alive, as long as we can prove that he is Henry Courtney.
Why don't they send the soldiers out to his ship and fetch him off?
Jan Oliphant wanted to know.
If they arrest him, do you think they will give the reward to us?
Anarchy asked contemptuously.
We have to catch him ourselves.
He may have sailed already, Jan pointed out.
No.
Anna shook her head with certainty.
No, my leaveling.
No English ship has set sail from the anchorage in the last 3 days. Another has arrived, but none has sailed. Look. She pointed out across the bay.
There they are.
The waters were flecked with white curling waves, and the ships of the fleet danced a graceful minuet to the music of the wind, bowing and prancing at their moorings, with their banners and colours unfurling and waving in a shifting rainbow. Hannah knew the name of every one of them. She reeled them off, until she came to the two Englishmen that lay so far out in the bay that it was impossible to distinguish their colours.
That's the Seraph. The one further back towards Robben Island is the Yeoman of York.
She mutilated the names with her heavy accent, then shaded her eyes.
There is a boat leaving the Seraph. Perhaps we are in luck, and our pirate is in it.
It will take nearly half an hour to reach the beach. We have plenty of time.
Jan Oliphant lay back in the sun, rubbed his bulging crotch expansively.
I have a great itch here. Come, Anarchy, scratch it for me.
She bridled coyly.
You know it's against the company law for us white ladies to milk a pint from any of you black bastards.
Jan Oliphant chortled.
I won't report you to Governor von der Stel, though I hear he likes a slice of dark meat himself.
Jan Oliphant wiped the trickle of saliva that ran down his chin from between his twisted lips.
My mother can stand guard for us. I don't trust you, Jan Oliphant. You bilked me the last time. Let me see your coin first,
Anarchy protested.
Oh, I thought we were sweethearts, Anarchy.
He leaned over and squeezed one of her fat round tits.
When we have the 10,000 guilders from the reward, I might even marry you.
Marry me?
She screeched with laughter.
I wouldn't even walk in the street with you, you ugly monkey.
He grinned at her.
It's not walking in the street we are discussing.
He grabbed her around the waist and kissed her on the mouth.
Come, my little pudding. We have plenty of time before the longboat reaches the beach. 2 guilders,
she insisted.
That's my special price for all my best sweethearts. Here's half a florin.
He pushed the coin into her cleavage. She reached out and massaged his crotch, feeling it grow in her hand.
1 florin, or you can dip it in the ocean to cool it off.
He snorted through his deformed nostrils and wiped the saliva from his chin as he scratched another coin from his purse. Anarchy took it from him, then tossed her head, throwing the wind-tangled mane of hair out of her face, and stood up. He picked her up in his arms and carried her down into the hollow between the dunes. Hannah watched them with disinterest from her seat on the top of the dune. She was worrying about her share of the reward money. Jan Oliphant was her son, but she had no illusions that he would not cheat her if he had the slightest opportunity. She would have to make certain that the reward money was placed in her own hands. But then neither Anarchy nor Jan would trust her either. She puzzled over the dilemma as she watched Jan butting away at Anarchy, his belly slapping loudly against hers. He was snorting and exhorting himself to greater effort with loud cries.
Yah! Yah! Like the hurricane! Like a leviathan spouting like the father of all elephants, tearing down the forest. Yah! Here comes yon elephant!
He let out a final bellow, slid off her, and collapsed in a heap on the sand beside her. Anarchy stood up, rearranged her skirts, and looked down at him disdainfully.
More like a goldfish blowing bubbles than a whale spouting, she said, and scrambled back up the dune to sit beside Hannah again.
The longboat from the Seraph was close into the beach now, its oars flashing and dipping, riding the crest of one of the swells.
Can you see the men in the stern?
Hannah asked eagerly. Anarchy shaded her eyes with one hand.
Yeah, two of them.
That one, Hannah pointed out the figure in the stern sheets. He was with Henry Courtney that night. They are shipmates. I could tell that.
A big man stood up and called an order to the rowers. In unison, they shipped their long oars and held them straight in the air like the lances of a cavalry troop. The boats slid in over the sands and came to rest, high and dry.
He is a big bastard, Anarchy remarked.
That's him for sure.
They watched Big Daniel and Captain Anderson step out of the longboat and strike out along the beach towards the settlement.
I'll go down and talk to the boatman, Anarchy volunteered. I'll find out which ship our man is on and if he is truly the son of Frankie the Pirate.
Hannah and Jan Oliphant watched her saunter along the water's edge towards the boat. The crew saw her coming and laughed and nudged each other, grinning expectantly.
Anarchy will have to be the one who collects the reward money for us, Hannah told her son.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. It's her boyfriend will be paying out.
They watched the girl laughing and bantering with the sailors. Then she nodded and led one of them into a small grove of dark green milkwood trees above the beach.
How much have you promised her as her share? Jan Oliphant asked.
Half.
Half?
He was shocked by such profligacy.
That's too much.
The first seaman emerged from among the trees, retying the length of rope that held up his breeches. His mates gave him an ironic cheer, and a second man jumped out of the boat and hurried into the grove, followed by a chorus of whistles and clapping.
Yeah, it's too much, Hannah agreed. She is a greedy bitch.
You watch. She will serve every last one of those English pigs.
Yeah.
She charged me 2 guilders. She is a greedy bitch.
We will have to get rid of her.
Jan shrugged philosophically.
You're right, my son. She deserves it. But only after she has picked up the reward money for us.
They waited patiently in the warm sunlight, chatting idly, making plans to spend the great fortune that would soon be theirs, watching the procession of English seamen, disappearing among the milkwood trees and returning minutes later, sheepishly acknowledging the friendly jeers and hoots of their companions.
"I told you she would fix every last one of them," Hannah said, with prim disapproval, as the last sailor returned to the longboat.
A few minutes later, Anarchy emerged from among the trees, brushing grains of sand out of her hair and clothing. She struggled up to where Hannah and Jan Oliphant sat with a smug expression on her chubby pink face. She flopped down beside Hannah.
"Well?"
Hannah demanded.
"The captain of the English East Indiaman Seraph is Sir Henry Courtney,"
Anarchy announced grandly.
"And you have the separate testimony of 8 of his sailors to prove it," said Hannah sarcastically.
Anarchy was unflustered and went on, "It seems that Henry Courtney is a rich English milord. He owns great property in England."
Jan Oliphant grinned. "As a hostage, he may be worth even more than 10,000. Me and my bullies will be waiting here on the beach to meet him when he comes ashore."
Hannah looked worried.
"Don't take chances by trying to hold him for ransom. He looks a slippery fish to me. Grab him, chop off his head, and hand it over to the VOC. Take the reward and forget about the ransom."
"Dead or alive?"
Jan Oliphant asked Anarchy.
"Yeah. That's what I said. My mother is right. A dead fish will not slip through our fingers. A fish with its throat cut,"
Jan mused.
"I will wait with you until he comes ashore. I will point him out to you, and then it's up to you and your boys,"
Hannah told her son.
"If he comes ashore a second time,"
Annika reminded her spitefully, and Hannah began to worry again. The cargo for Bombay had been taken out of the Seraph and ferried across to the Yeoman. The water barrels had been scoured and refilled from the stream that meandered down from the slopes of Table Mountain. Stores of lamp oil, salt, flour, biscuit, and other dry goods, which had been depleted during the long voyage south, were replenished. Hal had retrimmed the ship to her best attitude for sailing. The crew were in good health and spirits, fat and happy on this diet of fresh fruit, vegetables, and meat. and the 26 scurvy cases had recovered since Hal had sent them ashore to lodgings in the settlement. Now they came back aboard, cheerful and eager to continue the voyage. "I'll sail with the dawn tomorrow," Hal told Captain Anderson of the Yeoman. "Do you also make all speed to get to sea again?"
"Have no fear of that," Anderson assured him. "I'll be waiting at the rendezvous on the first day of December."
"And I will have good employment for you then," Hal promised him. "There is one last matter in which I must ask your assistance."
"You have only to name it."
"I am going ashore tonight to attend to some business of importance to me."
"Pardon my impertinence, Sir Henry, but is that wise? As you have confided in me, and as I have myself ascertained by discreet inquiry to the Dutch authorities in the colony, they have unfinished business with you. If you fall into their hands, that will certainly redound to your disadvantage."
"I am grateful for your concern, sir, but my business ashore cannot be neglected. When it is done, I shall have a small chest for you to convey to Bombay on my behalf. From there I will be in your debt if you can consign it by the very next vessel leaving that port to my eldest son in Devon."
"You may have complete confidence that I shall do so, Sir Henry."
Tom and Dorian had watched the preparations for the shore expedition with mounting fascination. They had discussed it between themselves for several days. When Hal picked out the men who were to accompany him and issued equipment and weapons to them, their curiosity overflowed. Gathering their courage, the two crept down to their father's cabin when they knew he was safely closeted there with his officers. While Dorian played the cat on the companionway ladder, Tom sneaked to the door and listened at the panel. He could hear his father's voice.
"You, Mr. Tyler, will have charge of the ship while I am ashore. We may be hard-pressed by the Dutch, and in some haste when we return, so the boat crew waiting for us on the beach must be alert and well-armed, ready to take us off at any instant. You must be ready to come to our assistance, Mr. Tyler, and as soon as we are back on board, to weigh anchor and set sail, even in the dark of night."
Tom led Dorian back on deck. The two climbed into the rigging and sat side by side on the mainyard. This was the place where they went when they wanted not to be overheard.
"It's tonight. I heard Father giving his orders. He's taking an armed raiding party ashore tonight," Tom told his little brother.
"So now we know what the chest is for, don't we?"
"Do we?"
Dorian asked doubtfully. They had watched a working party under Big Daniel bring the mysterious chest up from the hold. It was the size of a small sea chest, made of polished teak, beautifully dovetailed and joined with a screw-down lid.
"Of course we know," Tom said importantly. "Father is going to fetch Grandfather's body from the place where Aberley hid it."
Immediately Dorian was intrigued.
"Will he let us go with him?"
Tom lifted his cap and scratched his head dubiously.
Dorian persisted. "You aren't afraid to ask him, are you, Tom?"
He knew that challenge was the best way to get Tom to do what he wanted.
"Of course not,"
Tom denied indignantly. Nevertheless, he had to screw his courage to the sticking point before he could bring himself to venture again to the stern cabin.
"You let me do the talking,"
he whispered to Dorian as he knocked at the door.
"Enter," his father called brusquely, and then as he saw who it was, "Oh, it's you two, is it? However important your business, lads, I have no time to attend to it now. You will have to come back later. We'll talk tomorrow." Caps in hand, but with dogged expressions, the pair stood their ground. Tom pointed at the polished teak chest that now reposed in the centre of the cabin deck.
"Dorian and I know that you are going to fetch Grandfather Francis tonight. That's the coffin you have brought from home for him."
Hal was drawing the loads from the pair of pistols that lay on the desk in front of him, inserting the corkscrew down the barrels and pulling out the old ball, wad and powder charge to replace them. He looked up from the task and studied their serious expressions. At last he sighed.
"Ah, well, you found me out," he grunted. "No point in denying it."
"We want to come with you," Tom said.
Hal looked up at him, startled, then dropped his eyes back to the pistol and went on with the loading. Deliberately, he measured a charge of powder from the flask, poured it into the muzzle, and rodded it home firmly. Then he took a cloth patch from the brass patch box and wrapped the half-ounce lead ball with it. This would make a perfect fit in the barrel. The pistol was a lovely weapon, built by George Trulock of London. The grip was of curlicue-grained walnut.
"Your wound is not yet healed, Tom," he
said, still without looking up.
"It's healed clean," Tom protested and touched his flank. "It was naught but a scratch, even at its worst."
Hal made a pretense of admiring the locks of the double-barreled pistol. They were chased with a gold inlay, and the octagonal barrels were rifled. This would impart spin to the ball in flight and stabilize it to an accuracy that was unheard of in smoothbore weapons. If he trusted himself to hold true, Hal knew he could hit a target the size of his own thumbnail with every shot at 20 paces. He tapped the wrapped ball home with a small wooden mallet, then primed the pan. "Even so, I don't think that yours is a very good idea," he said.
"He was our grandfather. We are his family," Tom insisted. "It's our duty to be there with you."
He had chosen his words with care and rehearsed them. Family and duty were two concepts his father never took lightly. Now he reacted to them as Tom had hoped he would. He laid aside the loaded pistol, stood up, and went to the stern window. For a while he remained there, hands clasped behind his back, staring out at the land. At last he spoke.
"Perhaps you're right, Tom. You are old enough, and you know how to take care of yourself in a fight."
He turned back to the pair. Tom was exultant, his expression shining.
"Thank you, Father."
Dorian was tense with expectation, watching his father's lips for his next utterance. "But not you, Dorian. You're still too young." Hal tried to soften the blow with a kindly smile. "We don't want to lose you yet." Dorian seemed to crumble beneath the rejection. His expression was stricken, and his eyes welled. Tom nudged him sharply and whispered out of the side of his mouth, "Don't cry, don't be a baby." Dorian gathered himself and with huge effort fought back the tears.
"I'm not a baby."
He stood brave and tragic.
"He's a beautiful boy," Hal thought as he studied his son's face.
Dorian's skin was gilded by the tropical sun, and his curls caught a ray of sunlight through the stern window and shimmered like spun copper. Hal was struck again by the child's resemblance to his mother. He felt his resolve waver.
"I'm not a baby. Give me a chance to prove it, please, Father."
"Very well." Hal could not resist him, though he knew it was unwise.
"You may come with us."
Dorian's face was incandescent with joy, and Hal hastened to qualify his agreement. "But only as far as the beach. You will wait for us there with Alf Wilson and the boat crew." He held up one hand to forestall the protests he saw coming. "That's enough. No argument. Tom, go to Big Daniel and tell him to issue you with pistol and cutlass." They went down into the longboat an hour before sunset. There were only four of them in the shore party: Hal, Ubberly, Daniel Fisher, and Tom. They each carried a tinderbox and a bullseye lantern. Under their dark boat cloaks, they were armed with a cutlass and a brace of pistols apiece. Ubberly had a large leather sack folded and tied around his waist. As soon as they were settled on the thwarts, Alf Wilson gave the order to cast off. The boat crew pulled on the long sweeps, and they crept in towards the beach. In both bows and stern, long-barreled falconets were mounted, murderous small hand cannon loaded with grapeshot. There were pikes and cutlasses laid on the deck between the rowers' feet, ready to hand. No one spoke, and the oars dipped and swung without a sound, except the drip of seawater from the blades. Alf Wilson had muffled the rollocks. In the silence, Tom and Dorian exchanged excited grins. This was one of the adventures they had dreamed about and discussed with fevered anticipation so often during their long duties in the crow's nest. It had begun. Hannah Markenbach was lying in the grove of milkwoods above the beach. She had been there every daylight hour for the last 3 days, keeping watch on the distant silhouette of the Seraph as she rode at anchor. 3 times she had seen boats coming from the English ship and had watched them eagerly through the lens of the long brass telescope that Jan Oliphant had lent her. Each time she had been disappointed when Hal Courtney was not on board. At last she was becoming discouraged. Perhaps Anarchy was right. Perhaps he would not come ashore again. Her own son was rapidly losing interest in the hunt also.
For the first 2 days he had been at her side, watching with her, but in the end he had given up hope and gone off to join his men in the drinking hells along the waterfront. Now she watched the shape of the longboat coming from the Seraph, barely visible against the darkening waves. She could not contain her excitement. "He comes in the darkness like he did last time, so that no one will recognize him." She held the longboat in the round field of the lens. She watched its prow touch the beach, and her heart leapt with excitement, then raced. There were merely a glimmering of light remaining in the western sky as the tall figure stepped from the longboat onto the white sand and looked around the dunes and scattered bush with an alert turn of his head. For an instant he stared directly at Hannah's hiding place, and a fluke of the light struck his face, picking out his features unmistakably. Then the light faded and died away, so that even through the glass the boat and its crew were just a dark blob at the edge of the white beach.
"That's him," Hannah breathed. "I knew he would come."
She strained her eyes as a small party of men detached itself from the dark shape of the boat. They picked their way through the heaps of white driftwood that were piled at the high water mark, then came towards where she lay. She closed the telescope and shrank back against the bole of the nearest milkwood. The men came on without speaking, until they were so close she thought she must be discovered. Then, without check, their boots crunching in the loose sand, they passed her by, so close she might have reached out and touched their legs. Looking up, she saw Hal Courtney's face lit by the last of the sunset. Then the men passed on to disappear into the thick scrub, heading inland. She gave them several minutes to get well clear, then lurched to her feet and ran down the path leading to the town. Her heart was singing, and she exulted aloud.
"I've got him now. I am going to be rich. All that money. I am going to be rich."
In single file, Abelie leading, they skirted the settlement, giving it a wide berth. They encountered no human being, even when they crossed the road that ran along the base of the mountain towards Salt River and the scattered farms of Constantia. Once a dog must have scented them, for it burst into hysterical barking as they passed, but no one challenged them. The slope of the mountain reared beneath their feet, and they leaned forward against it. The bush became thicker, but Abelie seemed by instinct to find the narrow game paths and led them upwards. The dense forest closed out the stars above them, and both Howl and Big Daniel stumbled occasionally. As Tom's eyes were young, his night vision was still sharp. He picked his way sure-footedly through the shadows. Abelie was a creature of the forests, and moved silently as a panther ahead of them. Suddenly they came out on a bluff of bare rock high above the settlement.
"We'll rest here," Howl ordered.
As he found a seat on one of the lichen-covered stones, Tom was amazed at how high they'd climbed. The stars seemed very close, vast whirls of silvery light, bewildering in their infinite multitudes. Below them, the pinpricks of yellow candlelight in the windows of the buildings were insignificant against that splendid display. Tom drank from the leather bottle Abelie handed him, but no one spoke. Yet the night was no longer silent. Small creatures scurried in the forest around them, and the night birds hooted and screeched. From down the slope came the hideous giggling chorus of a pack of hyenas scavenging the rubbish heaps and dunghills of the Dutch settlement. It was a sound that made the hackles rise on the back of Tom's neck, and he had to resist the impulse to draw closer to Abelie's dark protective bulk. Suddenly a warm puff of wind struck him in the face, and he looked up at the night sky to see the stars blotted out swiftly as a heavy bank of cloud swept in from the sea.
"A storm coming," Abelie grunted.
And as he said it, another gust swept over them on the exposed bluff. In contrast to the first, it was icy cold, and Tom shivered and pulled his cloak tighter around his shoulders.
"We must hurry on," Hal said, "before the storm hits us."
Without another word, they rose and went on into the night, which was dark with storm clouds and clamorous with wind. The trees thrashed and clattered their branches overhead. As he stumbled along behind Abelie's tall figure, Tom began to doubt that anyone, even Abelie, could find his way through this dark night and darker forest to a secret place he had last visited 20 years ago. At last, when it seemed that half the night had wasted away, Abelie stopped below a sheer cliff of splintered rock, whose summit was lost against the dark sky above them.
Both Hal and Big Daniel were panting audibly from the long climb. Abelly was the oldest of them all, but he and Tom were the only ones still breathing easily. Abelly knelt and placed his lantern on a flat rock in front of him. He opened the shutter and worked with the tinderbox. A shower of bright sparks flew from the flint and steel, and he held the flaming tinder to the lamp wick. Holding the lantern high, he moved along the foot of the cliff, shining the pale beam onto the lichen-painted rock. A narrow cleft opened abruptly in the cliff face, and Abelly grunted with satisfaction. He moved into it. It was only just wide enough to accommodate his broad shoulders. A short distance in, the crack was choked with trailing lianas and dangling shrubs. Abelly hacked them away with his cutlass, then dropped to his knees when he reached the end of the cleft.
"Hold the lantern, Klebby,"
he handed it to Tom. In its beam, Tom saw that the end of the cleft was sealed with rocks and boulders. With his bare hands, Abelly prized one free from the wall and handed it back to Daniel. They worked in silence, gradually clearing the opening to a low natural tunnel in the cliff. When it was open, Abelly turned back to Hal.
"It is fitting that only you and Klebby should enter your father's resting place," he said softly. "Daniel and I will wait here."
He unwound the leather sack from his waist and handed it to Hal, then stooped to light the wicks of the other lanterns. When he had finished, he nodded to Daniel and both men moved away along the foot of the cliff, leaving Hal and Tom alone to complete their sacred duty. They stood in silence for a while, with the storm wind buffeting them and flapping their cloaks like vultures' wings. The light of the lanterns cast weird shadows on the rocky walls of the cliff.
"Come, lad."
Hal led Tom into the rock cleft, then went down on hands and knees to enter the dark mouth of the tunnel. Tom passed him the lantern and followed. The sounds of the storm faded behind them, and suddenly the tunnel opened into a cavern. Hal rose to his feet, the rock roof hanging only inches above his head. Tom stood up beside him and blinked in the yellow light of the lantern. He found himself in a tomb that smelt of the dusts of antiquity, and he was struck with a religious awe that stifled his breathing and made his hand tremble. At the far end of the cavern there was a natural stone platform. A gaunt human figure squatted upon it, staring directly at him with huge empty eye sockets. Tom recoiled from it instinctively and choked back the sob that rose in his throat.
"Steady, lad."
Hal reached out and took his hand. He led him step by step towards the seated figure. The wavering lantern light disclosed the details as they drew nearer. The head was a skull. Tom knew that the Dutch had beheaded his grandfather. But Abelly must have replaced his head upon his shoulders. Fragments of dried skin still hung on the bone like the dead bark of a fever tree trunk. Long dark hair hung down the back of the bony head, lovingly dressed and combed. Tom quailed, for his grandfather's empty eyes seemed to be looking deep into his soul. He drew back once more, but his father held his hand firmly and chided him gently.
"He was a good man, a brave man with a great heart. There is no reason for you to fear him."
The body was bound in the skin of a beast, a pelt of black hair, which the bacon beetles had gnawed off in patches, giving it a leprous look. Hal knew that the executioner had quartered his father's body, crudely hacking it into pieces on the scaffold with a cleaver. Abelly had tenderly assembled those parts and bound them up in the hide of a freshly killed buffalo. On the floor below the stone platform were the remains of a small ritual fire, a circle of ash and black charcoal sticks.
"We will pray together,"
Hal said softly, and drew Tom down beside him on the stone floor of the cavern.
"Our Father, which art in heaven," Hal began, and Tom clasped his hands before his eyes and joined in the recital, his voice growing more confident as the familiar words rolled off his tongue. "Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven."
While Tom prayed, he scrutinized from between his fingers the array of strange objects that had been laid out on the rock platform, grave offerings that he realized Abelly must have placed there all those years ago when he had laid grandfather's body to rest.
There was a wooden crucifix, set with abalone shell and bone, and water-worn pebbles that shone softly in the lantern light. There was a crudely fashioned model of a three-masted ship with the name Lady Edwina carved into her transom. Then a wooden bow and a knife. Tom realized that these were symbols of the forces that had dominated his grandfather's life. The one true god, a tall ship, and the weapons of a warrior. Abeli had chosen his last gifts with love and perception. When they had finished the prayer, they were silent for a while. Then Hal opened his eyes and lifted his head. He spoke quietly to the skeletal, skin-bound figure on the platform above them. "Father, I have come to take you home to High Weald." He laid out the sack on the platform. "Hold its mouth open," he ordered Tom, then knelt over the body of his father and lifted it in his arms. It was surprisingly light. The dry skin crackled, and small tufts of hair and flakes of skin fell away. After all this time, there was no odour of putrefaction, just the scent of fungus and dust. He slid the hunched body into the sack, feet first, until only the ancient ravaged head remained exposed. He paused to stroke the long black tresses of hair shot through with strands of silver. Watching that gesture, Tom was struck with the love and respect it demonstrated. "You loved him," he said. Hal looked up. "If you had known him, you would have loved him also." "I know how much I love you," Tom replied, "so I can guess." Hal slipped one arm around his son's shoulders and hugged him briefly but hard. "Pray God you never have to perform such an onerous duty for me," he said, then pulled the sack over Francis Courtney's head and secured the leather laces tightly. He stood up. "We must go now, Tom, before the storm reaches its height." He lifted the sack carefully and swung it over his shoulder, then stooped to the entrance tunnel of the cave. Abeli was waiting for them outside the cavern, and he made as if to relieve Hal of his burden, but Hal shook his head. "I will carry him, Abeli. Do you lead us down this mountain?" The descent was more hazardous than the climb had been. In the darkness and the roaring wind, it would have been easy to miss the path and step out over a precipice, or stumble on one of the treacherous scree slopes and break a leg. But Abeli led them unerringly through the night, until Tom felt the gradient ease, and the rock and rolling pebbles under his feet give way to firm soil, then to crunching beach sand. A bolt of vivid blue lightning tore open the clouds, and for an instant turned the night to brilliant noonday. In that moment they saw the sweep of the bay before them, its surface churned to confusion by the gale, boiling and foaming, leaping and spouting white. Then the blackness closed over them again, and the thunder crashed down in an avalanche of sound that numbed their eardrums. "The longboat is still there," Hal shouted his relief above the wind. The stark, fleeting image of the boat was imprinted upon his vision. "Hail them, Abeli!" "Seraph!" Abeli bellowed into the night, and heard the reply faint upon the storm. "Ahoy!" It was Alf Wilson's voice, and they started down the dunes towards it. Hal's burden, which had weighed so lightly at the beginning of the descent, now bowed him over. But he refused to relinquish it. They reached the foot of the dunes in a close group. Abeli opened the shutter of the lantern and shone the feeble yellow beam ahead. "On guard!" he shouted a desperate warning as he saw in the light that they were surrounded by the dark figures of men or beasts he could not be certain which. "Defend yourselves!" he cried, and they threw open their cloaks and drew their blades, instinctively forming a ring, back to back, facing outwards, the points of their levelled weapons forming a circle of steel. Then lightning broke over them again, a blinding bolt that split the low clouds, lit the beach and the gale-beaten waters. In its light they saw a phalanx of menacing shapes charging down upon them. The lightning flashed on the naked blades they wielded, on the clubs and spears they brandished, and for a moment it revealed their faces. They were all Hottentots, not a Dutch face among them. Tom felt a rush of superstitious dread as he saw the man coming at him. He was as hideous as a thing from a nightmare. Long tresses of black hair writhed in the wind like serpents about the terrible face. A livid scar slashed through the bloated nose and purple lips. The mouth was twisted and deformed, drooling saliva, and the eyes flashed fiercely as the creature rushed at him.
Then the darkness closed over them all again, but Tom had seen the man's sword raised over his head, and he anticipated the stroke, twisting aside his shoulders and ducking under it. He heard the blade hiss past his ear, and the explosive grunt of the effort his attacker put into the blow. All Aberley's training came to the fore. Tom went smoothly on the riposte, lunging for the sound of the man's breathing, and felt his blade sink into living flesh, a sensation he had never experienced before, which startled him. His victim shouted with pain, and Tom felt a surge of savage joy. He recoiled and shifted his feet, quick as a cat, and lunged blindly again. Once more he felt the hit, the soggy slide of steel into flesh, then the clash as the point struck bone. The man squealed, and for the first time in his life Tom rode the wild exhilaration of battle lust. The lightning flamed across the heavens, and Tom saw his victim reel away. His sword dropped into the sand. He was clutching at his deformed face. His cheek was laid open to the bone, and the blood was black as tar in the blue light, pouring in a sheet down his chin and splashing over his chest. Tom saw in the same flash of lightning that both his father and Aberley had killed. Their victims were down, one kicking and convulsing in the sand, the other curled into a ball, clutching his wound with both hands, his mouth open in a silent cry of agony. Big Daniel was engaged, blade to blade, with a tall, sinewy figure, naked to the waist, body black and shiny as an eelskin, but the rest of the attackers were backing away, repulsed by the vigour of the little knot of defenders. Darkness shut down over them like the slamming of a door, and Tom felt Aberley's fingers close on his upper arm, his voice close to his ear.
"Back to the boat, Clebby. Keep together."
They ran blindly through the soft sand, bumping into each other. "Is Tom with us?" His father's voice was harsh with concern for him. "Here, father," he shouted. "Thank God. Danny?" "Here." Big Daniel must have killed his man, for his voice was close and clear. "Seraph," Hal bellowed, "on me." "Seraph," Alf's voice acknowledged the order, and the lightning flared again to reveal it all. The four of them were still 100 paces from where the longboat lay at the edge of the roaring sea. Led by Alf, the 8 men waiting with it were running to join the fight, brandishing their pikes, cutlasses and boarding axes. But the pack of Hottentots had rallied, and like hunting dogs were baying at their heels. Tom glanced over his shoulder and saw the man that he had wounded had recovered and was charging along at the head of them. Though his face was a mask of blood, he was slashing the air with his sword and screeching a war cry in a strange language. He had singled out Tom and was rushing directly at him. Tom tried to estimate how many there were. Perhaps 9 or 10, he guessed, but the darkness closed down again before he could be sure. His father and Alf Wilson were shouting to keep contact with each other, and now the two groups came together. Immediately, Hal called, "Meet them! Skirmish line!" Even in darkness, they smoothly executed the manoeuvre they had practised so often on the Seraph's deck. Shoulder to shoulder, they stood to meet the attack, which burst into them like a wave out of the night. There was the clatter and clash of metal on metal, and the shouts and curses of men struggling together. Then the lightning flared again. Hannah staggered at the edge of the Milkwood Grove with 15 men. The night had been too long for them. The fury of the storm debilitating and the boredom of the ambush had overcome them. They had crept away into the grove to find a spot out of the wind in which to curl up and sleep. Then the shouting and the sounds of battle had roused them. They had seized their weapons and now poured out from among the trees. The lightning revealed the struggling, evenly matched men close to the water's edge where the empty longboat lay. In the same flash, Hannah saw Henry Courtney clearly. He was in the first rank of the fight, his face turned towards her, his cutlass lifted high in his right hand, then slashing down at the head of one of the Hottentots. "'Dis home!' Hannah screeched. "'It's him! 10,000 guilders for the picking! Come, girls! Come, lads!' She waved the pitchfork with which she was armed and charged down the dune. The men who had hesitated at the edge of the grove were galvanised by her example. Now they raced down behind her, a howling, shrieking mob. Dorian was alone in the longboat. He'd been curled up asleep on the floorboards when the fighting started, but now he crawled to the bows and knelt behind the falconet. He was wide-eyed with sleep, but in the lightning he had seen Tom and his father beset by the enemy and the new threat rushing down upon them from out of the dunes.
During battle practice on the Seraph, Abberley had shown Tom how to swing and aim the falconet in its swivel seating, and how to fire it. Dorian had watched avidly and begged for a chance to try it. As always, he'd been met with the infuriating answer, "Hey, you are too small. When you are older." Now was the chance he had been denied, and Tom and his father needed him. He reached for the length of burning match in the tub of the sand below the gun. Alf Wilson had lit it and placed it at hand for just such an emergency. He took it in one hand, seized the long monkey tail of the falconet with the other, and swiveled it in the direction of the screams and shouts of the mob charging down the dunes. He looked over the barrel, but could not see the sights of the gun, nor any glimpse of his target in the darkness. Then the thunder crashed directly overhead, and the beach was lit brilliantly by the lightning. Directly under his barrel, Dorian saw them coming, led by a witch from mythology, a terrible female creature waving a pitchfork, long grey hair streaming out behind her, her white dugs swinging and flopping out of the bodice of her gown, a face ravaged by age and debauchery, screaming. Dorian pressed the burning match to the touch-hole of the falconet. 20 feet of flame shot from its muzzle, and a bucketful of grapeshot, each ball the size of a man's eye, was hurled down the beach. The range was just sufficient for the blast to reach its optimum spread. Hannah caught the full brunt of it. A dozen lead balls shattered her chest, and one struck her in the centre of the forehead, taking the top off her skull like the shell off an egg. She was flung backwards into the white sand, with another 6 of her troop down around her. The rest staggered with the shock and disruption of the air around them. 3 of those still on their feet howled with terror and fled back towards the protection of the grove. The others were stunned and milled in confusion, stumbling over their dead companions, some bleeding from their wounds, uncertain which way to turn. The burning wad from the falconet was blown into the long windrow of dry driftwood at the top of the beach. The flames took hold swiftly, and fanned by the wind, burned brightly, showering blue sparks from the salt crystals, which lit the beach with a wavering, flickering light. The fight swung back and around. Although they had reduced the odds against them with pike and blade, Hal's men were still heavily outnumbered. Hal had 3 men against him, circling him like a pack of hyena harassing a black-maned lion. He was fighting for his life and could not even glance in the direction of his son. Jan Ullifant was intent on his revenge for the gaping slash across his cheek, and he went after Tom, swearing and shouting his rage, using only the edge of his sabre with wild cuts and overhead slashes. Tom gave ground before him, outmatched in height, reach and strength by the burly Hottentot. For these fatal seconds, Tom was on his own. He could count on no help from Abberley or Daniel or even his father. His manhood would have its full flowering this night, or he would die on these blood-soaked sands. He was afraid, but not unmanned by his fear. Rather, it gave power to his wrist and sword arm. He found something within him that he had not known was there until this moment. He fell naturally into the rhythmic fighting grace that Abberley had instilled into him through all these years of training. Now that the flames from the burning driftwood were lighting the beach, he found his confidence growing. He felt the steel in his arm, and he realized that the brute he faced was a brawler and not a swordsman. Although the power in his swinging blade was enormous, it was as irresistible as a landslide. Tom did not make the mistake of trying to match it. Instead, he anticipated each wild hacking stroke before it was launched. There was no subtlety in the way Jan Ullifant signalled his intention with his glaring eyes and contorted blood-smeared face, or in how he moved his feet and opened his shoulders to make the stroke. As it came whistling down at Tom's head, he reached out and touched it with his own blade, never attempting to stop it in the air, lightly deflecting it so that it flew harmlessly an inch past his head. Each time Tom did this, Jan Ullifant's rage swelled until it overwhelmed him. He held his sword high above his head with both hands and rushed straight at Tom, roaring like a bull seal in the rut. He made no attempt to cover himself from any counterstroke, and his body was wide open. Hal winged one of his antagonists, hitting him high in the right shoulder with his riposte. The man screamed and reeled back, dropping his sword, clutching at his wound. The other 2 Hottentots, fighting on each side of him, lost heart and dropped back. Hal had an instant of respite to glance around in the flickering light of the flames. His heart froze in his chest as he saw Tom stand full in the path of the towering Hottentot captain. They were too far for Hal to intervene before Jan Oliphant charged home. A shout of warning and despair rose in his throat, but he choked it back. It would have served only to distract Tom. Tom was as pale as the sand beneath his feet, but his face was set and hard with determination, his eyes bright and intent, no glimmer of fear in them, as he sighted over the weaving point of his sabre. Hal expected him to drop back before the charge of the huge beast of a man bearing down on him. The set of his shoulders and the balance of his slim body signalled just that intention. But suddenly his left foot swung forward, and he launched himself en flèche, like an arrow from a bow, straight at Jan Oliphant's throat. The big man had no time to bring down his guard or turn aside from the thrust. Tom's point caught him precisely in the hollow at the base of his neck, an inch above where his collarbones met. It flew deep, a handspan through Jan Oliphant's throat, found the juncture of two vertebrae in his spine, and severed them cleanly. The steel drove on, until smeared pink with blood in the firelight, it sprang out a foot from the nape. The raised sword fell from Jan Oliphant's nerveless fingers, and his limbs flew wide, for a moment forming a dark crucifix against the flames. Then he fell backwards, hitting the sand with all his slack, lifeless weight. Tom's blade jerked free, plucked from the dead man's throat by his own weight and momentum, and the air from Jan Oliphant's lungs was driven out through his punctured windpipe in an explosive sigh by the force of his fall. It burst from the wound in his throat in a tall pink feather of froth. There was a long moment when every man on the beach froze and stared at the grotesque corpse. Then one of the Hottentots, facing Hal, wailed with despair, turned and fled up the dunes. In an instant the others were racing after him in panic, leaving their dead and wounded where they had fallen. Tom was still staring down at the man he had killed. His face crumpled, and he started to shake with shock and the release of fear and rage. Hal went to him immediately and placed an arm around his shoulders. "Well fought, lad," he said, and hugged him.
I killed him," Tom whispered, in tones of disbelief.
"Before he killed you," Hal told him.
He looked around at his men scattered along the beach.
"Which of you fired the falconet?" he shouted against the wind. "That saved us all."
"Not me, nor me."
All heads turned towards the longboat, and they stared at the small figure in the bows.
"Not you, Dorian?"
Hal asked in wonder.
"Yes, father."
Dorian held up the smoking slow match in his hand.
"Oh, two cubs of the old lion," said Aberley softly. "But now we should go, before the garrison from the castle comes to that cannon and the fire."
He gestured at the piles of burning driftwood.
"Did we lose anyone?"
Hal shouted.
"I saw Dick Foster go down."
Alf Wilson shouted back, and went to kneel beside the body. There was a fearsome wound in his chest. Alf felt for the carotid artery in the man's throat beside his windpipe.
"He's gone. Any others?"
Hal asked.
"No, only the one," Alf replied.
Hal felt a lift of relief. It could have been much worse. He could have lost a son or a dear friend.
"Right, then. Get Dick into the boat. We'll give him a Christian burial when we get to sea."
He picked up the leather sack that held his father's remains.
"What shall we do with this trash?"
Big Daniel kicked one of the wounded Hottentots, and the man groaned.
"We should slit their throats."
"Leave them. Don't waste time."
Hal looked around and saw that half of his crew had shallow cuts and sword nicks, but none had bothered to remark on it. This was the first time he had seen them fight. "They're a good, hard crew, indeed," he thought, with satisfaction. "They will give good account against Jangiri, or any other foe."
"Back to the boat,"
he ordered, and four men picked up Dick Foster's body, handling it with respect, and laid it on the floorboards.
Hal placed the leather bag beside it, then jumped over the stern to take his place at the tiller. The men seized hold of the boat and ran it down over the sands as easily as if it were a coracle. The bows were thrown high by the first wave, and they leapt aboard and seized the oars. "Heave away!" Hal shouted, and the next storm-driven wave crashed over the bows, tumbling aboard so that they were flooded knee-deep. "Heave!" Hal exhorted them, and they shot forward, climbing at an impossible angle up the steep slope of the next wave. They reached the crest and hovered a moment on the very brink of capsizing, end over end, then dropped forward and hit the trough with a crash. "Heave!" Hal roared, and they shot out into the clear where the waves were tall, but not steep enough to upend them. Half the men set aside their oars and began to bail her out, while the others rowed hard for the distant Seraph. "Dorian!" Hal called the boy to him. "Sit by me." He spread the wing of his cloak over his son, and under its cover hugged him close. "How did you learn to fire the falconet?"
"Tom showed me," Dorian said uncertainly. "Did I do wrong?"
"You did well." Hal hugged him harder. "God knows, you could not have done better."
Hal carried the leather sack into the stern cabin. The two boys followed him, seawater pouring from their clothing, onto the deck. The Seraph plunged and rolled at her anchor cables as the storm lashed her mercilessly. Hal laid the sack and its precious burden on the deck beside the coffin. The screws that held down the lid were already loosened, and it took only a few turns to free them. Hal lifted the lid and laid it aside. Carefully he placed the leather sack in the chest. He had to turn and angle it to get it to fit. Then he packed raw oakum around his father's corpse to prevent the fragile bones being shaken and broken during the long voyage ahead. Tom helped him replace the lid. He took the turn screw from his father's hands. "Let me have the honour, father."
"You've earned it," Hal agreed.
"Both of you. Let Dorian help you." He handed the younger boy another turn screw from the tool chest and watched them secure the coffin lid. "We will give your grandfather a Christian service when we lay him in the stone sarcophagus in the crypt at High Weald that I prepared for him 20 years ago," he told them, and wondered if all his sons would be together on that day. He put the gloomy doubt from his mind as he watched them finish the task. "Thank you," he said simply, when they had finished. "Go and change into dry clothes. Then see if in this foul weather the cook still has a fire burning in his galley and can give you something hot to eat and drink." At the door he stopped Dorian. "We can never call you a baby again," he said. "You proved tonight that you are a man in everything but size. You saved all our lives." Dorian's smile was so radiant, and even with his sea-wet locks dangling in his face he looked so beautiful that it twisted Hal's heart. Soon he heard the two brothers chattering away in the tiny cabin beside his, which had been vacated by the Beatty daughters, then their running footsteps in the passageway as they went off to importune the cook. Hal lit two candles and placed them on the lid of his father's coffin. Then he knelt on the deck in front of it and began the long vigil. Sometimes he prayed aloud for the peace of his father's soul and the forgiveness of his sins. Once or twice he spoke quietly to him, remembering incidents from their life together, reliving the frightful agony of Sir Francis's death. Though the night was long and he was exhausted and cold, his vigil ended only when the dawn light, grey with the storm, crept through the stern windows. Then he roused himself and went on deck. "Good morning, Mr. Tyler. Call both watches to get the ship under way," he bellowed above the wind. The watch came tumbling up on the heaving deck. The forecastleman manned the capstan, and the pawls clanked as they recovered her anchor cable. In the meantime, the topmen poured into the rigging and manned the yards. Hal ordered the foresail spread for a moment to give the ship way to break out the anchor flukes from the sandy bottom, then furled the sail again as she came up hard. He listened to the capstan pawls. Clank, then clank again. Silence for a long moment, then clank and clank, coming faster until it became a rattling chorus as the anchor broke out and the cable slithered in through the hawse hole. "Headsails!" Hal roared. and as they broke out, the storm snatched them drum tight. The Seraph quivered eagerly, and as Hal ordered helm put over, she spun on her heel and frolicked away. The men in the rigging let out a spontaneous cheer. A moment later, Tom's voice hailed from the masthead. "On deck there! A boat!" "Where away?" Hal shouted back. "Putting out from the beach. Now there are two of them." "No, three." Hal crossed to the lee rail and raised his telescope. The sea was dreary grey, flecked with whitecaps. Low clouds scudded across the sky and obscured the mountain top. He picked out the three longboats, battling the wind and the tide, throwing bursts of spray over their bows, heading towards the Seraph. "Visitors, Captain," said Ned at his elbow. Hal grunted and focused his telescope. He could pick out the Dutch uniforms and the glint of bayonets. "I do not think they have anything to tell us that we want to hear, Mr. Tyler," he shouted with a snap. Clearly there were troops from the castle. Last night's fracas on the beach had stirred them up. He turned his back on the distant flotilla and smiled as he gave the next order. "Lay the ship on a course to pass the Yeoman of York close to leeward, if you please, Mr. Tyler." Half a cable's length from the Yeoman, the Seraph hove to and launched the longboat. The teak chest was lowered into her as she danced alongside. Then Hal dropped down the ladder and took the tiller before he gave the order to pull across to the anchored yeoman. Anderson was at the rail, and Hal stood in the stern sheets and hailed him. "I have the cargo for you." "I am ready to receive it," Anderson shouted back, and his crew lowered a tackle from the main yard. The longboat crept in under it, and working swiftly and deftly, they secured the teak chest to it. "Hoist away!" Hal called, and his father's coffin was raised and swung in onto the yeoman's deck. "I am greatly obliged to you, sir," Hal cried to the deck high above. "My great pleasure, sir," Anderson answered. "I wish you a fair wind." He touched the brim of his cocked hat in salute. "Until we meet again," Hal said. Then Guy's head appeared at the rail. He looked pale, as if the first throes of seasickness had already overtaken him. Nevertheless, he smiled bravely and waved his cap over his head. "Farewell, father, until we meet in Bombay." "Farewell and farewell," Hal replied, and felt a sharp pang of sorrow at this parting. "Would that our fates had treated us all more kindly," he thought. But he smiled encouragingly at Guy, trying to convey a message of love and hope to him, until he was forced to give his whole attention to bringing the longboat back alongside the Seraph. Although the whipping pendulum action of the Seraph's foremast in this wind and sea had made the climb both hazardous and frightening, Tom and Dorian were at last secure in the crow's nest. They could look down from there onto the yeoman's deck as they passed the anchored ship so closely that they could clearly make out the expressions of the passengers and crew looking up at them. "There's Guy!" Dorian whipped off his cap to wave at his brother. "Guy! Ahoy there, Guy!" Guy raised his head and looked up at them, but his hands remained clasped behind his back, and no smile relieved the severity of his expression. "Why does he not answer me?" Dorian asked plaintively. "I have not given him offence." "Don't trouble yourself, Dorry. It's not you he hates. It's me," Tom said quietly, and returned his twin's cold glare. Behind Guy, the Beatty family stood in a small group together. With him they had come on board the yeoman days before from their lodgings in the settlement, ready for the sailing of the ship to Bombay. Caroline stood a few paces, separated from the rest of her family, and Tom picked her out. She made a pretty picture in these surroundings, her skirts and petticoats rippling and flirting in the wind, holding her bonnet on with one hand, her curls dancing on cheeks pink from the wind's touch, eyes sparkling as she looked across at the other tall ship. "Caroline!" Tom yelled. "Up here, ahoy!" The devil was in him, and he called her more to infuriate his twin than for any other reason. Caroline raised her eyes and saw him high in the crow's nest. She did a little impromptu dance of excitement and waved with her free hand. "Tom!" The wind whipped her voice away, but Tom's sharp eyes could read her lips. "Godspeed!" Guy spun round when he heard her voice, then strode across the deck and stood close by her side. He did not touch her, but his posture was possessive and belligerent as he stared across at his brother. The Seraph broke out more sail, and she heeled sharply and flew away on the wind. The figures on the yeoman's deck dwindled in size, and then were lost to sight. From the crow's nest they stared back at the other ship until she was a distant shape on the horizon, almost lost beneath the dark mountain and the towering ranges of sullen, bruised cloud. "Now it's just you and me," Dorian said sadly. Tom did not answer. He could think of nothing to say. "You won't ever forget the oath you swore to me," Dorian insisted. "You won't ever leave me." "I won't forget it," Tom said. "It was a dreadful oath," Dorian reminded him. "The very strongest kind." "I know," said Tom, and repeated, "I won't forget it." He rubbed the tiny white scar at the end of his thumb. After leaving Table Bay, the Seraph was 23 days without glimpse of land or the sun. They ran into torrential downpours of rain, so copious that it seemed the very ocean had been upended and was crashing down on the deck. The rains lasted days and nights without cessation. In such conditions, even Hal's navigation was sketchy and without substance, relying entirely on the traverse board and dead reckoning of each day's run. "This is usually a placid, sunny ocean," Aberley remarked, looking up at the tumbling clouds low overhead. "Ah, the sea devils have turned it on its head." "There is some great disturbance out there in the east," Ned Tyler agreed. "The wind turns over us like a wheel, always altering the direction of its thrust." "We have met these winds before," Big Daniel reminded them. "They spin around like a child's top. I have heard that they are not uncommon in these latitudes at this season of the year. But we are not at the centre." He broke off as a mountainous swell, even taller than all the others, marched down upon the ship with ponderous dignity. It was so high as to dwarf the Seraph, and its crest reached above her foretop yard. The yawning trough between this one and the swell that had preceded it was over a league wide. Hal left his position by the lee rail and crossed quickly to the helm. "Bring her up 2 points," he ordered quietly. "Meet her," he said. As the wave crashed down, they wallowed in the trough for a long moment. The men around the wheel held their breath, then released it together as the Seraph kicked up her head. "Mr. Fisher is right," Hal nodded at him. "These storms spread out from their centre for hundreds of sea miles. They'll sweep the entire ocean from end to end. But give thanks to God that we are not at the centre of this one. The strength of the wind there could probably rip out the mainmast, though we flew not a scrap of canvas upon her." Big Daniel spoke again. "In the Mascarene Islands I have seen one of these devil's winds tear out the largest palm trees by its roots and carry it a mile out to sea, flying as though it were a kite." "Pray for a sight of the sun," Ned Tyler looked up at the looming overcast sky, "that we might at last be able to fix our latitude." "I have given us a wide berth of the land," Hal glanced at the binnacle, then looked into the west. "We should be at least 200 miles clear of the African mainland." "But Madagascar is one of the largest islands in the world, almost 10 times the size of Ireland, and it lies right across our path," Ned pointed out quietly so that the helmsman could not hear him. There was nothing to be gained in alarming the crew by discussing the hazards of navigation in their hearing. At that moment there came a hail from the masthead. "Deck! Flotsam! Fine on the port bow!" The group of officers peered ahead, and Hal shouted through the hailing trumpet, "Masthead, what do you make of it?" "Looks like the spar of a ship or the..." The lookout broke off, then went on excitedly. "No, it's a small boat, but almost swamped. There are men in her." Hal hurried up to the bows and jumped onto the bowsprit. "Yes, by God," he said. "Castaways, by the look of them. Alive, too, I can see one of them moving. Stand by to launch a boat and pick them up." Bringing the Seraph down on the small boat was difficult, dangerous work in these conditions of sea and wind. But at last Hal could lower a boat and send Big Daniel and the crew to the rescue. There were only 2 men in the battered craft, which Big Daniel abandoned, for it was not worth the labour of salvaging it. They brought the two survivors up in a bosun's chair, for they were far too weak to climb the ladder. Dr. Reynolds was there to meet them, and he examined them as they lay on the deck. They were both only semi-conscious. The salt had flayed the skin off their faces. Their eyes were swollen almost shut, and their tongues were blue and bloated from thirst, so that they filled their mouths and protruded between their lips. "Water is their first need," he grunted. "Then I will bleed them both." Their tongues were so swollen that they could not drink, so Reynolds introduced a brass syringe into the back of their throats and squeezed sweet water into them. Then he smeared mutton grease thickly over their salt-scalded lips, faces and arms. The effect of the younger of the two was miraculous. Within 2 hours he'd recovered sufficiently to be able to speak lucidly. However, the older man was still unconscious and seemed to be sinking fast. At Dr. Reynolds' summons, Howell went down to the corner of the gun deck where they were lying on straw pallets. He squatted beside them and watched the surgeon bleed the younger patient. "I should take another pint," he told Howell as he finished. "But this one is rallying strongly, and I've always been a conservative physician. One pint will do for now." He closed the wound with a dab of tar and bound it up with a clean cloth. "The older man is not faring as well. I shall take 2 pints from him." He began work on the still figure on the other pallet. Hal observed that the younger man, indeed, seemed brighter after this treatment, and leaned over him to ask, "Do you speak English?" "Aye, Captain, that I do," the sailor whispered. The Welsh lilt was unmistakable. "What is your name, lad, and what ship?"
"Taffy Evans, begging your pardon, Captain. From off the company's ship Nile, God have mercy on her."
Slowly and gently, Hal drew his story out of him. As a precaution against piracy, the Nile had been sailing in a convoy with 2 other ships outward bound from Bombay to England, with a cargo of cloth and spices, when they had run full into this terrible cyclonic storm 100 leagues north of the Mascarene Islands. Battered by the ferocious winds and gigantic seas, the Nile had become separated from the other ships of the convoy and taken on water. On the 5th day during the 2nd dog watch, she had been hit by a monstrous swell. Heavy with the water in her bilges, she had capsized and gone under. So swift had been her end that only a handful of men had got away in a boat, but they had neither water nor food with them, and most had perished swiftly. After 12 days, only the 2 remained alive. While he was talking, Dr. Reynolds had bled 2 pints from the other patient. He had just sent away his assistant to empty the blood-filled bowl overside when he exclaimed with chagrin, "Devil take it, the poor wretch is dead. I had hoped to save him." He turned his full attention back to Taffy Evans. "I think we will get this one through, though. When you are fully recovered, there will be a berth for you on full pay and with a share of the prize money." Howell stooped under the low deck. "Will you sign the watch bill?" Taffy touched his forehead with a weak grin. "Right gladly, Captain. I owe you a life. Welcome aboard, sailor." Howell ran up the ladder to the deck and paced easily against the heavy roll and pitch of the ship. Finding these castaways had been fortuitous, as was the storm that was now gradually dissipating its power. They gave him the excuse for which he had been seeking. When he had the details of his plan firmly in mind, he called his officers down to his cabin. They gathered around the chart spread on his writing desk. "All of you know that for 200 years the centre of all trade and commerce on the Fever Coast has been here," he said, and touched the tiny cluster of islands marked on the chart. "Zanzibar. Logically, that is where our search for Jangiri must begin." They nodded in agreement. Every one of them had sailed this ocean before, and they knew well how the 3 small islands of the Zanzibar group were situated ideally for India, the Red Sea, and the Persian Gulf, and only a few leagues off the African mainland. The islands lay full in the track of the monsoon winds, which reversed themselves with the change of the seasons. The southeasterly monsoon carried shipping from India to Africa, and when the season changed, the northwesterly monsoon facilitated the return voyage. Added to this, Zanzibar had a secure harbour on the main island of Unguja, and even in the worst season of the rains it was relatively free of the dreaded malarial fevers that turned the African mainland into a death trap. Since as far back as the rise of Islam, it had always been the entrepot to Africa, and the ocean of the Indies, and the market where the produce of Africa, slaves, gold, ivory, gum arabic, the precious frankincense, was traded. Alf Wilson spoke up diffidently. While I was their captive, I heard the pirates speak often of Zanzibar. I formed the impression that they visited it regularly to trade part of their booty, to sell their captives in the slave market, and to refit and revictual their fleet. "Did it seem to you that Jangiri used Zanzibar as his main base?" Hal asked him. "No, Captain, it did not. I believe that he would not place himself in the power of the Omani Sultan by doing so. I believe that Jangiri has another secret hideaway, but that he uses Zanzibar as his trading port. It has been my intention ever since our quest began to call at Zanzibar. However, what has troubled me is to explain what business an English ship of force is doing in these waters, so far from the regular trade route between India and Good Hope." Hal looked around the circle of their intent faces and saw both Big Daniel and Ned Tyler nod. "Indeed, if we sail into Zanzibar, the word will spread down the coast within a week that a squadron of pirate hunters has arrived and Jangiri will take fright. We will never bring him to battle unless we can give good, innocent reasons for being in these waters." "The storm has given us that reason," Hal told them, "and the castaways we found have suggested the excuse we lacked." They looked at him curiously. "What story will you tell the consul in Zanzibar?" Ned Tyler asked. "I shall tell him that we were part of the convoy from Bombay that included the luckless Nile. My story will be that we are laden with rich cargo. I will dream up the details of a treasure so fabulous that it will have Jangiri salivating in his beard when he hears of it." They all laughed delightedly at the thought. "We ran into the heart of the great storm and were battered by it, just as the Nile was." Hal looked across the desk at Ned Tyler. "We have already concealed the greater part of our armament, but now I want you to send down some of our yards and spars to give the appearance of storm damage to rigging and hull that will convince a watcher from the shore of the truth of our story. Can you do that, Mr. Tyler?"
"Indeed I can, Captain," Ned said with relish.
"Such damage will give us the excuse to linger in Zanzibar roads, while the news of our plight is carried by every spy and trading dhow up and down the coast." Hal enlarged on his plan. "By the time we leave port again, every corsair and rover from the coast of Jeddah will be drawn to us like wasps to a pot of honey." Despite the heavy seas, the work of transforming the Seraph was begun at once. Ned seemed inspired by the task that Hal had set him, and his carpenters used paint of mixed colours to patch and dapple the hull. He had an old suit of sails from the Atlantic voyage brought on deck, then deliberately sullied and tattered it. He selected certain parts of the rigging, including some of the upper yards and spars, for removal, so that the ship's sailing qualities would not be too adversely affected. These would be sent down as soon as land was in sight. The Seraph would present a truly sad, bedraggled appearance when she limped into Zanzibar harbour. 3 days later, the skies began to clear, and although the seas were still high and unruly, the tropical sun burned down on them once again. The effect on the spirits of the crew was gratifying to Hal, as he watched them set about their duties with new heart and vigour. At noon he was able to make his first sunshot in all those weeks of sailing. He found that the ship's position was on the 12th parallel of south latitude, 250 miles further north than his dead reckoning had suggested. "Depending on our eastings, we should raise Madagascar Island within the week," he commented, as he marked the new position in the ship's log, and ordered a change of course up into the west, towards the island and the African mainland. As always, the birds gave warning of the proximity of land. These were of a species that neither Tom nor Dorian had ever seen before. They saw fairy terns with plumage white as frost on a December morning at High Weald, and long-tailed tropic birds hovered over the shoals of small fish that darkened the surface in their multitudes. Closer to the island, they came across villainous-looking frigate birds, black as hell with scarlet throats, hanging on the high currents of the monsoon wind. They were lying in ambush for the flocks of terns as they returned from their fishing forays. Tom and Dorian watched them dive on their quarry with wings shaped like the blade of a half-folded clasp knife, forcing their victims to disgorge the hard-won fruits of their labours, then swooping to gobble the partly digested fish from their crops. The sea changed colour, taking on a yellowish hue. When the boys asked why, Abeli explained.
The rains of the great storm have engorged the rivers of the mainland, and they have discharged their muddy floodwaters into the sea. We are very close to land now.
The next morning, as the dawn exploded silently in the eastern sky behind them, and turned the horizon the colour of fire opals and rose petals, from the masthead they saw a blue wavy line scored across the horizon ahead of the ship's bows.
Land!
The joyous cries rang through the ship. Howell knew these islands well, and as the day wore on he climbed into the rigging and was able to identify the blue mountains of the north tip of Madagascar as they rose higher and higher from the sea. All that day both watchers laboured at the heavy work of slinging down the spars from the topmasts to make the ship appear storm-crippled. Without her top canvas the Seraph became balky and recalcitrant, and when close-hauled she refused to sail more than 8 points to the wind. However, the trade winds were behind her, and Hal was able to free her sails and lay her on a direct course towards the land. It was as well they completed this work before the ship sailed closer in and met any of the small fishing dhows that would report their arrival in these waters and describe the Seraph's condition. The following noon, Cap d'Ambre, at the northern tip of Madagascar, lay 10 leagues off their port beam. With this fix on his position, Hal was able to shape a course directly across the Mozambique Channel for Zanzibar. This inner sea was bejewelled with lovely little islands. The Seraph wove her way between them, sometimes so close they could see the dark, half-naked islanders waving from the white beaches. The sailors climbed into the rigging and waved back lustily, speculating on the gender of the tiny figures on the sand. These waters were dotted with the sail of small trading vessels and fishing dhows. As the Seraph passed, their crews called questions in Arabic and other unintelligible languages. To the delight of the Seraph's men, there were women in some of the dhows.
"By God, I can see that one's titties from here, brown as a pair of Easter buns hot from the oven. Then I'll lick the sugar coating off them, so help me I will. Say you'll marry me, you little heathen beauty, and I'll jump overboard this moment," one of the topmastmen shouted. "They don't understand the word marry. Just tell them jig-jig. They'll understand that well enough," his mate suggested.
The faint tinkle of delighted feminine laughter from the dhow drifted back to confirm the wisdom of this counsel. Through his telescope, Howell could make out damage to the palm trees and the other vegetation on the islands they passed, while the debris and floating rubbish that speckled the surface of the ocean confirmed the storm's passage, and that their excuse for being in these waters would be strengthened when they reached Zanzibar. "If we do not run into Jangiri first," Ned Tyler pointed out dryly, "we have already made such a ripple in these waters that news of our arrival must be speeding ahead of us." Hal was aware of the danger of Jangiri springing the trap prematurely, for they were now in his home waters. He redoubled his vigilance. The lookouts were warned of the danger, and the crew kept in a state of alert. Because of the work on the gun ports, Hal could not exercise the gun crews, but he kept them busy with sword practice and musketry. These precautions proved superfluous, though, for they saw no large ships, and within 10 days they had raised the African mainland. Since leaving Good Hope, this was Tom and Dorian's first sight of Africa, and whenever they could escape from their labours in Master Walsh's classroom, from the Arabic lessons with Alf Wilson or their other duties, the boys climbed to a masthead and sat for hours discussing the mysterious land out there, the wonders and adventures it promised them. The Seraph bore northwards along the coast, sometimes close in to the capes and coral reefs of the mainland, and the boys longed for glimpses of weird beasts and savage black tribes. But Africa seemed vast, enigmatic, and deserted. Finally, Ungunja appeared ahead. There were two other smaller islands in the group, Pemba and Latham, but when sailors spoke of Zanzibar, this was the island to which they usually referred. It was crowned by the massive fort, built of sparkling white coral blocks that glistened like an iceberg in the sunlight. Its ramparts bristled with heavy cannon. Hal tacked into the entrance of the ancient harbour. A mass of four-and-a-half rigged craft was anchored in wild disorder, congesting the harbour. Some of the ocean-going dhows were almost as large as the Seraph. These were the traders from India, Muscat, and the Red Sea. However, there was no way of telling if any were corsairs. Probably all of them are, given a chance. Hal smiled to himself, then gave his full attention to bringing the Seraph safely to rest. He dipped his colours to the fort in courtesy to the Sultan's representative and dropped anchor at the limit of random shot from the batteries. He had learned long ago to mistrust even the most warm, open welcome of any African potentate. A swarm of small boats came out to greet them as soon as they were at anchor, offering wares to cater for every need or vice, from green coconuts to bundles of narcotic bung leaves and flowers, from the carnal services of small brown slave boys and girls to porcupine quills filled with gold dust. "Make certain that none of this rabble are allowed on board," Hal warned Big Daniel, "and keep a weather eye on our own lovely lads, that they do not try to sneak ashore for a bottle and a bit of fun. I'm going to visit the British consul, although I do not expect him to be the same man I saw 20 years ago, when last we visited this place. What was the fellow's name?"
"Gray, as I recall, Captain."
"That's right, Daniel, William Gray, and as likely a rogue as remains unhanged." Hal took a small party ashore with him, including Aberley and 5 armed seamen. The longboat deposited them on the stone quay below the thick white walls of the fort. Aberley cleared a way through the throng of merchants and idlers, and they entered the warren of small alleys and lanes that were barely wide enough for 3 men to walk abreast. The stench from the open sewers that ran down to the harbour was strong enough to catch in their throats and made Hal's gorge rise. The heat, where no breeze entered, was stifling, and their sweat had soaked through the back of their shirts before they had gone 100 paces. Some of the buildings were 3 stories high, and none of the walls was true. They leaned and bulged out, almost meeting overhead. The upper balconies were screened with intricate latticework, and faceless female creatures in black veils peered at them through the zenana screens. This was the season of the monsoon, which brought the slavers from all the far reaches of the eastern shores. Aberley led them through the main slave market. It was a large souk, open to the sky, but shaded by a grove of banyan trees, with weird serpentine trunks and thick dark green foliage. The ranks of slaves for sale squatted in the shade of the spreading boughs. Hal knew they had worn their chains from the day of their capture deep in the African interior, during the long, heartbreaking journey down to the coast, and in the slave decks of the dhows that had brought them across the channel. Some of the men were branded on the forehead, the scars still pink and freshly healed. These markings denoted that they had been castrated in the barracoons on the beaches of the mainland. They were destined for the China trade. The emperor had decreed that no black slaves could be imported who were capable of bastardizing the pure bloodline of his people. The price of these gilded creatures was almost doubled, as losses due to the crude surgery and cauterization were high. The buyers from the ships in the harbour were inspecting the offerings and haggling with the slave masters in their ankle-length robes and headcloths. Hal shouldered his way past them and entered the maze of lanes on the far side of the souk. Although 2 decades had elapsed since his last visit, Aberley led them unerringly to the heavy door of African mahogany that opened onto the noisome street. It was studded with iron nails and intricately carved with Islamic designs and texts from the Quran, in which no figure of man or animal, which might be construed as idolatry, was depicted. A slave in long black robes and turban answered the jangling bell.
"Salam alaikum."
He touched breast and lips and bowed in welcome.
"My master knows of your coming and waits eagerly to welcome you."
He looked at the small party that followed Hal.
"There is refreshment for your men."
He clapped his hand for another slave to lead them away, and Hal followed him into the courtyard where a fountain played and banks of flowering hibiscus sweetened the stench from the street. For a moment he did not recognise the monstrous figure that lay on a pile of cushions in the shade beside the fountain. He hesitated and stared at him until behind the bloated features he could make out the vestiges of the man he had once known.
"Salaam alaikum."
William Gray, His Majesty's consul to the Sultanate of Zanzibar, greeted him. Hal almost replied in the same language, but stopped himself. He did not want to let Grey know that he was fluent in Arabic. Instead, he said, "I am afraid I have not a word of that heathen tongue, sir. I was led to understand that you were English. Do you not speak a Christian language?"
"Pardon me, sir. It is a matter of habit," Grey smiled ingratiatingly. "I am William Grey, His Majesty's consular representative to the Omani Sultanate. Forgive me for not rising to greet you."
Grey made a deprecatory gesture that took in his ruined body and swollen elephantine legs, which were covered in running ulcers. Hal recognised the ravages of dropsy.
"Please be seated, sir. I have been expecting your visit since I received reports of your arrival in the harbour."
"Good day to you, sir. Captain John Black at your service." Hal remembered that Grey was a Christian apostate who had embraced Islam. He suspected that the man's change of faith had been more for financial and economic considerations than from religious conviction. Obviously, Grey neither recognised nor remembered Hal, and it had been a safe bet that he would not. Hal had banked on this when he had given Grey a false name. It was essential that the pirates did not become aware of his true identity. 20 years before, Hal had earned the Arabic name of El Taiza, the Barracuda, for his fighting exploits when he had spread terror throughout the fleets of Islam during the Ethiopian War in the Horn of Africa. If he were to lure Jangiri to attack him, his enemies must not be given any inkling of the true identity of the man against whom they were pitted. Hal seated himself on the cushions that had been placed for him. A female slave carrying in a tray on which was set out 2 silver coffee thimbles, and a second woman carried a tall silver pot on its own charcoal brazier. The slave girls were both young, slim and supple-waisted. Grey would have paid at least 200 rupees for each. Hal remembered that Grey had made a vast fortune from trafficking in the slave trade, and the sale of licenses and commissions from the Sultan. At their last meeting he had tried to interest Hal in both these propositions. Hal guessed that this was not the limit of his nefarious activities, and he had no illusions as to the man's integrity or morals. That he was in league with Jangiri and his ilk was not beyond the bounds of probability. One of the girls knelt before Grey and filled the thimbles with the bitter black beverage, viscous as honey. Idly, Grey caressed her arm, as he would a pet cat, with a hand on which the gold rings and jewels had sunk into the putty soft flesh of his swollen white fingers.
"You have had a good voyage, Captain?"
"A voyage not without incident, sir," Hal answered. Grey must already know every detail of the condition of the Seraph, and was merely seeking confirmation. After leaving Bombay in convoy with 2 other ships of the Honourable East India Company, we were beset by a fearful gale off the coast of Madagascar. One of the other vessels went down with all hands lost, and we escaped only with great damage to our hull and rigging. This is the main reason why we have called at this port, which was not my original intention."
"I am sorry to hear of your misfortune." Grey shook his head in sympathy. "But grateful that you have graced us with your presence and that of your fine ship, I pray only that I may be of service to you and provide you with whatever stores you need."
Hal gave him a seated bow and thought, no doubt at inflated prices, and for a goodly commission. He marvelled at the changes that age and the disease had wrought in Grey. He had been young and vigorous when last they had met, but now his pate was bald and his beard silver-white. His eyes were weak and rheumy, and the smell of death was upon him.
"Thank you, sir. I am grateful for your good offices, particularly since I am conveying a cargo of peculiar value and political importance to His Majesty King William."
Grey stirred his vast body, and a sparkle of interest shone in his watery eyes.
"As I am His Majesty's direct representative in these parts," he murmured, "might I be permitted to know the nature of this cargo?"
Hal drew in his breath sharply at the suggestion, then lowered his gaze to study the ornamental fish that drifted in the waters of the fountain. He rubbed his temples thoughtfully and made a show of pondering the wisdom of acceding to this request. At last he sighed.
"As His Majesty's representative," he said, "you of all persons should be informed."
He hesitated again, then seemed to make up his mind. He lowered his voice to a conspiratorial level. "I am entrusted with the conveyance of the gift that Aurangzeb, the Mughal Emperor of India,
is sending to His Majesty to celebrate his coronation.